We spent the last month talking to people in all of the counties we serve about homelessness, what causes it, and what people are doing about it. Out in the Cold is the name of the series of interviews. Through it, we've learned a lot. Like, for one thing, it's uniformly hard to find a decent place to live at an affordable price anywhere in the region. We've learned that some agencies have to go to great lengths to protect homeless people, like the Klamath County Agency that rents motel rooms on extremely cold nights. And we've learned that there are many, many reasons people end up homeless, so many different approaches are needed to get them back into permanent shelter. We finished the series today by talking about recent approaches and what might work in the days ahead. We have four guests scattered around the Western world. Robert G. Marbot, Jr. at Marbot Consulting is joining us today. He has done a number of bits of work for some counties, particularly on the California side. Dr. Marbot, thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Dan Bryant is with us once again. He's the executive director at Square One Villages in Eugene, which includes Opportunity Village Eugene and two others. Hi, Dan.
Good morning.
We also have with us Mohammed Hassan Awad, who's a doctoral student at the University of Oregon Lundquist School of Business. We'll have him explain the connection in just a moment. Hi, Hassan.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. And in the studio with me is Constance Wilkerson, who is fairly new to the job in the Rogue Valley. She is the Continuum of Care Homeless Prevention Coordinator, not working for Jackson County government, but for the geographical area of Jackson County. Constance, thank you for joining us. And why don't we start with you, if you can just tell us a bit about the title seems self-explanatory, but is this a new position or just you new in it?
This is a new position. Previously, the Homeless Task Force was completing many of the tasks, such as the PIT count and the housing inventory count. And the continuum of care is a concept that you can get collaboration across all different social service providers and housing providers so that you're able to house the most vulnerable first. And each agency will not just be advocating for their clients. So we're developing this system to prioritize vulnerability and to make sure that those with the highest vulnerability are housed most rapidly.
Sort of a triage situation. You decide
yes.
These are the cases that are most in need. Dr. Robert Marbot, your name popped up so many times as we were talking to the counties in California. It's good to finally have you on the program. Tell folks about what it is you do and how long you've been doing it on homelessness.
Well, I've been working in the area of homelessness for about 35 years, but I did it mostly from a volunteer or an elected policy for about 20 years. And then I was getting real frustrated that everybody was working on the symptoms and not working on really the root causes. So about 10 years ago, I just totally changed my focus and our team's focused into working on identifying the scope, scale, and structure of local communities and really trying to design programs to go after the root causes, which has been very different what's traditionally been done that works at the symptom level.
What has been the greatest revelation? Let's start with one, and we can expand the scope later. What's been the greatest revelation in causes of homelessness for you?
Well, one size does not fit all, and they're really different triggers for different groups. You have the mental health, behavioral health, which is obviously a major portion of what we all work on. You have your addictive services, addictions, but generally the addictions are sort of what I call self-medicating. If you're on the street, you don't have the finances to be a recreational drug user. So it's really much more in the self-medicating. And then what you're seeing growing all across the country is the military post-traumatic stress, the acute stress, and military sexual trauma, which are triggering a lot. And then predominantly within the female family communities, you have the domestic violence. And so each has a different trigger. So if you don't work on that trigger, you find out you can actually make things worse rather than better. It's like going to a hospital and getting the wrong diagnosis and then getting the wrong treatment.
All right. We'll come back and talk much more about causes as the hour goes on. Dan Bryant at Square One Villages. For the folks who came to know you as just Opportunity Village Eugene, what prompts the name change?
Well, Square One is the name of the nonprofit. Opportunity Village is just one of our local projects. We started with that and decided to branch out because when we built that, we discovered we were able to get people off the street, help them stabilize themselves and their financial situations and then get them moved into housing, but we couldn't find the housing for them to move into. It's just there's just an incredible dearth of housing for small households of one and two individuals. The wait list here locally through our local housing authority was over 6 years to get into anything that they have. So we decided to build our own. And our first pilot project called Emerald Village Eugene is partially operational, still under construction, but we have a couple of residents now living in tiny homes. So we're building a new model of affordable housing for about a third of the cost that traditional the cost of traditional affordable housing, so that we can get better bang for the buck using the concepts of both the village, community, and tiny homes, 160 to 250 square feet, to make it very affordable, so that someone whose only income, for instance, is Social Security or disability, and they've got $750, $800 a month, they can afford to pay $250 a month. But, of course, you can't find anything in the market at that. But we are building very high-quality, decent homes that can be rented at that price so that they can live decently, affordably, with the very modest income they have and not be dependent upon some other program, typically Section 8, which is also very hard to get.
Muhammad Awad, before we head to a break, can you give us a brief sketch on your involvement with homelessness issues at the University of Oregon?
Yeah, sure. So my research is basically about the how people get together to create these innovative solutions to solve or at least to alleviate the symptoms of poverty, and how different stakeholders group in the community react to these solutions, and from there, what kind responses that you get and how these responses affect the success or failure of the different solutions.
All right, much more to talk about as we discuss. This is our final version of Out in the Cold, our exploration of homelessness around the region. Muhammad Awad is a doctoral student at the University of Oregon. We also have Constance Wilkerson, Dan Bryant, and Robert Marbot on the line. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are exploring homelessness in our Out in the Cold series one final time, looking at sort of an overview of where things stand and where things might be going, things that have worked, things that haven't, lessons that have been learned. We have a varied panel with us today. Constance Wilkerson is the Continuum of Care Homeless Prevention Coordinator within Jackson County. Muhammad Awad is a doctoral student at the University of Oregon Lundquist School of Business. Dan Bryant is the Executive Director at Square One Villages in Eugene. And Dr. Robert Marbot is at Marbot Consulting in Texas. He's done a lot of work with homelessness, including at the White House level over 35 years. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Your thoughts about the causes of homelessness as you observe, whether you've been homeless, we'd certainly like to hear from you, whether you have seen solutions that have worked and some that haven't worked as well. Join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Muhammad Awad, I want to come back to you because when I look at your work in things like homelessness and food systems and social entrepreneurship, it looks like your work is often about systems and how they work. And I just have to wonder if homelessness at its heart is a failure of one or several systems.
It's more of a homeless. My work is mainly about complex social issues, mm-hmm. and you can take a systems approach to it. But when I look, for me, the homelessness issue, at least the way I see it in Eugene, which is my the only focus I'm looking at, it's an idea of a failure of a system in that there are multiple entities or multiple organizations that are part of this massive field, massive problem, and there's a lot of blind spots, a lot of miscommunications, a lot of different expectations of what is right and what to do. And this is where you get the, at least to me, the tensions around solutions, which consequently can lead to failure of some of the solutions.
When you talk about blind spots, what kinds of blind spots have you noticed in dealing with homelessness?
So far, this is my research. It's the second year that I'm collecting data, and I haven't analyzed as much. But what I found so far is that, first of all, there's different views of the experience of the solutions themselves. So how the unhoused population experience some of these solutions. The access to the services is also really hard there for many of the population. And this is where you get the pushback from many of the stakeholders here. And with this pushback, you get tension that eventually lead to either other things not working out or just the scattering of the field where you get smaller solutions out there that does not sort of stretching thin of the resources that you have. That end up just sort of being just a little Band-Aid that does not help as many people as possible.
Costas Wilkerson, I have the benefit of having you in the studio, so I can see when you nod in agreement with the speakers on the phone. And I just wonder, when we talk about Mohammed was just talking about in solutions that work for groups of people or even in individuals, when you're talking about the kind of triage you have to do in Jackson County and the continuum of care, I mean, is it really almost an individual, like this person's circumstances are unlike anybody else's? And for that reason, do you have to sort of resist categorizing people?
Yes, you should resist categorizing people. Each person that comes before us with a need to be housed has a different story and a different journey that's gotten them to the point of being homeless. There are similarities, sometimes loss of job, family distress, domestic violence. You know, we see some of these same scenarios in many, many stories. But we have to treat them individually, and so that is why the continuum of care has come up with this assessment tool, which we think works really well to get a good picture of what the person is living with, whether that be a disabling condition, how they arrived at homelessness, how long they've been homeless, what their support systems are like, if they have any. And so Mohammed is very accurate in saying that sometimes the resources seem like they've been stretched very thin and they're only acting as a Band-Aid on the problem. And so that's why we really want to work hard in the Valley to foster collaborations and to get people stably housed, because we have seen that once someone's stably housed, they're more able to go through substance abuse treatment programs, job programs, to get health concerns addressed, to get therapies, and to become able to continue keeping up with their treatments and therapies. And so yes, the resources are stretched very thin, but together we have enough resources. I really believe I'm becoming very optimistic on what we can do together here in the Valley.
Resources is one thing. What about housing, though? I mean, the story is not very different, I think, county by county. I mean, Dan Bryant in Eugene Springfield may have the toughest market around him, but I keep hearing 2% vacancy rates or lower in all the counties around us. So even if you can get a person up on their feet, they're able to pay and stuff, is it still a difficulty finding places for them to live?
There are various programs in the Valley, and I know that one of the ones at Access, SSVF, is looking
for... That's for veterans, right?
Is for veterans, homeless veterans. And that program is looking for landlords that might have places to rent, and there's been success with that. And so we have to look beyond the typical apartment or condo or house setting, and there are more units out there. And also different programs have housing associated with just their program. We're asking people to relinquish control of that, and so that all the housing units are available to those in need.
All right, let's take a call here. We have Chuck in Shady Cove on the line. We were talking about homelessness with Constance Wilkerson, Mohammed Awad, Dan Bryant, and Robert Marbot. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good. Yourself?
I'm okay. I have a question. I'm on a limited income. I get $1,000 a month Social Security. I retired 2 years ago with $35,000 in the bank, and I'm dwindling it down now. It's almost gone. I'm just wondering what I should do. I have a really nice fifth wheel trailer that I live in. and it's paid for. I was a commercial pilot for 30 years, but $1,000 a month really doesn't cover all my expenses. What should I do?
All right. That's an interesting question. Who wants to take that one on? Robert Marbot, right, imagine. Go ahead.
Well, this is Dan. I'm saying he's precisely the person that we're trying to build for. I can't offer him a solution except to say that there are many communities that we're working with who see the tiny house movement as a solution for that kind of, precisely for that kind of situation. Someone who is just economically in that situation where they can't afford the housing that's out there, that the market just doesn't provide that kind of housing. And so moving to this tiny house model as a way to do that. So you have to find, someone in your area that's wanting to do that. And most of the communities in Oregon now are looking at that. Unfortunately, it often takes a couple of years to develop something. But I clearly see that as an important solution for someone who doesn't need, assistance with addiction issues or mental health issues. They just don't have enough money. I really believe the tiny house movement is a solution to that problem.
And Jack, we just talked to somebody in Ashland yesterday who was looking at it as well. Is that Marbot I hear, Dr. Robert Marbot?
Yeah, yes. I'm going to just say why what Dan is doing is so important, what I call create your own inventory. I'm a real big believer you never look at anything without looking at the overall system. And if you think about just one real statistic, when Ronald Reagan took office in January 20th, 1981, there was an affordable housing gap of 1.9 million houses, not available, whether apartment, house, quadplex, any type of unit, any way you describe it. That number now, depending on which organization you look to for data, is between 8 and 14 million people, a gap in units. So the gap in units has gone from what we used to think we had a problem in the 1980s, has gotten 400 to 800% worse over time. And so the idea that there's going to be an affordable housing movement that solves the problem, you might as well waiting for Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny. It's just not going to happen, and you're not going to get the help from Washington. So the key moving forward is local communities trying to build their own inventory. And that's why I think there's so much promise in the tiny house movement, because that's a new clever way to try to create some affordability at a local level. And so the communities that are starting to really make headway are the ones that are taking on housing inventory themselves and developing it themselves.
And so, I mean, Robert Marbot, what do you attribute the increasing gap in affordable housing to? I mean, why have communities not been building more affordable housing over the years?
Well, the West Coast, to be real honest, has a very different issue than the Midwest. In the Midwest, you have affordable housing, for example. But basically, from San Diego to Seattle, you have building codes and permitting processes that are really making housing phenomenally expensive. Some of that's environmental, some of that's code and permitting, some of that is water and wastewater. But when you add all that up together, it makes a very expensive unit. So the West Coast has sort of a unique problem, and that's regulation. You go to Florida in the Gulf, you got a different problem that's triggered. You got the FEMA mapping problem after basically Hurricane Andrew and then later Rita and Katrina. It changed the maps, and so a lot of inventory was lost, and it ricochets through. Even if it's high-end beach property, then individuals move to middle, and then middle move to low, and then it pushes out the folks we work with. And then you also have, in Florida, gentrification of a lot of the high urban impact renewals pushed out a lot of the single resident occupancy. So it was replaced with $1 million condos, but there was no replacement back. And then the final one is the moving from a lot of mobile home parks that created a lot of affordable inventory are getting into the floodplains and are actually, if you go out and change the sign on the front, you got to completely change and go to hurricane windows and tie downs and all that, which suddenly adds $400 to $500 a month in rental. And so each part of the country is having different reasons why it's doing it. And until people start looking at that system level, this 8 to 14 million gap is going to become a 20 million gap pretty soon.
We are talking about a homelessness once again on the Jefferson Exchange as a conclusion to our Out in the Cold series running all through January and now obviously into the beginning of February. This wrap-up invites you to join the conversation with Robert Marbot from Marbot Consulting, Dan Bryant from Square One Villages in Eugene, Mohammed Awad, who's a doctoral student at the University of Oregon Lundquist School of Business, and Constance Wilkerson, who's with the Continuum of Care in Jackson County. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Constance Wilkerson, we mentioned that you are new to the job as the homeless prevention coordinator, but have been in the Rogue Valley for 15 years? Okay, so not unused to what goes on. One of the things we have heard through the Out in the Cold series is that the people you see on the streets don't really represent the bulk of the homeless population. Do you find that to be true, or what would be your own perspective on that?
I think they're wearing one component of the homeless situation. I know that when we do our point in time count that we do every January to document how many are sheltered or unsheltered here in the Rogue Valley, we find some people that are living in emergency shelters, which would be considered sheltered. We have some people that are living in camps in the Greenway, but we have a lot of people that are couch surfing, you know, because they just do not have the ability to make rent payments, either because they're working at very low-paying jobs or they've had some crisis that's happened in their family. And so it's really hard to categorize homeless. You have a lot of unaccompanied youth who really aren't part of a family unit anymore and are still maintaining their ability to go to school by couch surfing or, you know, living with friends. And you have people that are living in their cars. So just to say that the homeless are the people that you see on the streets, that's really inaccurate.
We were talking about the point in time count when you came in, because January 31st is the date of that, but it takes a while to compile that. And you mentioned a particular trend in Jackson County. So are the numbers actually rising over time?
They have. If we look at our numbers over the past few years, every year our count gets larger. And I think that's because we've gotten better at taking the count. The count this year happened in the night of the 22nd of January. And different agencies continue to take that count throughout the week, but they ask people, where were you housed or where were you staying in the night of the 22nd?
That's an important thing. You pick a point in time. You're not doing all the counting at that moment, but you ask people where they were at that moment.
Right. We do a lot of counting that night of the 22nd. And I think because we've gotten better at knowing where the camps are and at where people congregate, and where they're going for services, such as community meals, our numbers have consistently gone up year after year.
And Dan Bryant, I'm curious to know what the current situation is in Lane County, if you have any sense of this year's point in time count there.
It's a little early to say. I will be surprised if the numbers go down. We saw about 6-7 years ago, we were at about 2,000 on the count, and it dropped down to about 1,500 and stabilized for a couple of years. Last year, it went up slightly, and I really think it will this year. I think also, same as with Constance, that we're doing a better job, a lot more volunteers this year that we're doing that count, so we just make sure we get more accurate information. But I really believe, just from what I see on the street, just the number of people that I interact with, it's not just because of we're doing a better job. I think that the numbers have actually gone up, but time will tell. Unfortunately, it takes about 4 months to process all that data before it's released, so we won't know for sure until May.
Let's take a call here. We have Ben in Springfield on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi there. Yeah, my question is, why aren't cities and towns building more varied housing. I've been all over Europe, and I see a lot of cities and towns there. They have many different kinds of housing, especially large apartment complexes for seniors and for young couples and for single people. And I see here in North Eugene, they're still building these really large homes. I went to look at some of them. They're like mini mansions with 5 and 6 bedrooms, and seems ridiculous use of land. Why aren't the government agencies providing tax incentives to building smaller homes and units for the general population?
All right, let's,
the developers don't get into building these mini mansions. And then the big 800-pound gorilla in the room, which I've called a couple of times about, Jeff, is, you know, you're going to have this problem forever if you don't deal with the overpopulation issue. And there needs to be government commissions and discussions going on about controlling populations.
All right. Well, we're getting into a population discussion now from our discussion of homelessness. We'll have to pick up the answers from our panel on the other side of a break. We are talking about homelessness as the wrap-up to our series of explorations of homelessness county by county around the region out in the cold. We have with us Constance Wilkerson from Jackson County, Muhammad Awad from the University of Oregon Lundquist School of Business, Dan Bryant from Square One Villages in Eugene, and Robert Marbot from Marbot Consulting in Texas. We'll come back and get some answers to them and take more calls from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're finishing up our series of interviews about homelessness in the region out in the cold with a wrap-up to look at solutions applied so far and how well they've worked and solutions that might work in the future. We have four guests. Constance Wilkerson is the Continuum of Care Homeless Prevention Coordinator within Jackson County, not employed by the county. Muhammad Hassan Awad is a doctoral student at the University of Oregon Lundquist School of Business. He's been studying homelessness and stakeholders in homelessness solutions. Dan Bryant is the Executive Director at Square One Villages in Eugene. And Dr. Robert Marbot is the founder of Marbot Consulting, based in Texas, has been working on homeless issues for 35 years, including in the Bush 41 White House. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And Bob Marbot, I'm going to throw this to you, that last question from our caller about why communities. You've seen a bit more of the country in the process of working with homeless issues. And so you mentioned some of the restrictions in various places, but is there a lack of incentive, too, or a lack of market incentive even for people to build houses that are affordable?
It's both. And especially on the West Coast, pretty much San Diego up to Seattle has a very much more expensive build-out program. So whether you're building 1 square foot or 4,000, your starting cost is often 300% higher on the West Coast than the rest of the country, maybe except the Northeast. It's even more expensive on build-out than some of the Northeast. And I don't mean the materials. I don't mean the labor or the land. I meant just the government permitting costs. And so when you start with a high nut, what happens is the builder is incentivized to build bigger in order to get a higher margin. So rather than building 10 units with fixed costs, you build one unit and then mark it up more. And so until you deal with the cost of construction, and that can be simply forgiving fees, waiving permits and such, that's one part of it. The other is you absolutely need to start incentivizing mixed use. And if you give any sort of waiver, whether it's environmental or a cost or a permit or a time permit, you must say, and this is my view as a policymaker, you need to say X amount percent is going to be affordable. You can't just build all, as the prior caller said, $1 million mansions, especially if it's getting incentivized by government. And so you need to have some mixed-use property, incentivize that. But you also got to deregulate and get rid of the regulations and the cost of the permitting. So it's both sides of the coin. if you really want to be successful and start creating inventory.
Dan Bryant, as you look around the Eugene Springfield area and keep discovering new places where there are little niches for constructing small-scale shelters for people, do you see anything promising outside of what you're doing that looks like it would complement what you're doing in the sense of getting permanent homes built for people?
The Meyer Memorial Trust is one of the major foundations in Oregon, and they have their what they call their Affordable Housing Initiative, and funded five projects that were doing innovative things, and we were one of the five. And so they're looking at other models for how to lower costs using modular components, different strategies for funding and so forth. And so those are four of those are still emerging, haven't been built yet, but it's giving us some ideas of concrete things that can be done. And to the point that Robert just made, the other is system development charges. So, for instance, in our case, the Emerald Village, which is 22 tiny homes, the system development charges were $120,000.
Wow.
Fortunately, the City of Eugene values what we are doing, so they paid that for us. But they're looking at those issues, Springfield too, and trying to figure out a system whereby they can lower those costs. For instance, if you build what's called an ADU, an accessory dwelling unit, in your backyard, sometimes called the granny lot or the mother-in-law apartment, that kind of thing, a small tiny home that you build behind your house, it doesn't make sense to have the same system development charge that you would have for a 2,000-square-foot house. And so Springfield is lowering that cost, right, is looking at that to lower that cost to encourage people to put ADUs in their backyards that then you can use as income for yourself.
Let's take another call. We have Steve in Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Howdy.
Hi.
I am living in a 25-foot RV right now, so I'm not homeless. I got a toilet, I got a stove, et cetera, et cetera. But I am landless, and it took a while before I found an affordable space. And I was living on the streets, and there was nothing in Eugene, to accommodate my situation as a low-income guy.
And, Steve, you were living in a fixed place, weren't you? I mean, you've been a caller for longer than I've been a host of the program.
Oh, yeah, I was, and then I came into an inheritance, bought the RV, went on a bucket trip from here to the East Coast, figuring that, well, once I get back from this, I'll own my home, not the bank, not anybody but me. But I hadn't anticipated the fun that I would have just finding a place to park this thing. I had to be mobile for a while and just move from place to place around the city and hope I don't get ticketed.
Wow. All right. Thanks for sharing that story, Steve. It's good to hear from you. Constance Wilkerson, if you had a story like that in Jackson County, the kind of triage program we talk about at the Continuum of Care, how would you begin a move with somebody like that in your own county?
Of trying to find land space for them? Is that what you're asking?
Or some of you help with that situation. Yeah.
It really is difficult because in trailer parks, the lot fee, the different places call it, you know, different things, but very expensive every month. You know, we're trying to work with all the cities in Jackson County and see what land is available for something like this, for people looking for a place to put their mobile home or trying to find other spaces to establish something like Hope Village that's been successful.
In Medford. Which is modeled after Opportunity Village Eugene. Mm-hmm.
And on my Continuum of Care board, we have a lot of staff from city and county jurisdictions, and all of them are working very hard to find solutions.
Mohammed Awad, since you're not directly involved in provision of service, I wonder what kinds of things you have run across in your studies from an analysis perspective that struck you as like, well, that's interesting. I wonder why they do that.
Well, a couple of things have kind of popped up so far. First one is related to the unhoused students around campus, which is it's like a ghost story. University denied, it's really hard to find out the number, the exact scope of the problem, and it's probably because of what Carlton said, is that a lot of different situations, and many students end up couch surfing or just staying at friends' places or in their cars, so it's hard to gauge the problem. But it's there, and there are some services that are starting to pop up to help this population. Another one is the how hard it is to implement. That for me, coming from a different country, was surprising. Is that it's how hard it is to implement one simple solution that is temporary at best, or something like Egan Warming Centers, and how difficult it is to open centers around the city, or something like the rest stops, and how much time and effort it takes just to get one rest stop started. With some that provide basic services, not to solve the problem, but just to make life easier for the unhoused population. But there's a lot of people working on the issue, which I found very refreshing, and things are moving. It's just that for me, it's the difficulty of getting things through, even not the affordable housing, not the big solutions, just the simple ones that help people on a day-to-day basis, which is what I'm looking at.
Robert Marbert, 35 years at this, did you think 35 years ago that we would not be having these conversations by this point in history?
Well, what concerns me is that we, in many ways, and I think Dan and, you know, the continuum cares all up and down the coast are starting to see it, that the numbers are going back up. We sort of were going up, but then we went down a little bit. We went flat. But most of the West Coast is starting to report, you know, the early point in time data is starting to report 20% increases year over year. And that's what really concerns me, is we're going the wrong way on mental health beds and units nationwide. We have significantly much less mental health, behavioral health resources. And then you have the housing costs going up. And those two things, both one's sort of the root cause and then one is the symptom and how you try to solve it. And we're going the wrong direction with both those trends. And that's what's really scary to me.
So the housing costs going up, the mental health beds dropping.
Right. Because, and both of those, you know, started as feds. Again, I hate to pick on Ronald Reagan's number, but in 1980, there were roughly 475,000 federally funded mental health and behavioral health beds nationwide, the whole system. And partly because of the deinstitutionalized movement on the left and then on the right, trying to get out of the budget, not thinking mental health as a federal budget item, the two sort of movements collided. And now we have roughly under 100,000 federally funded mental health beds. You know, and it's hard to match apple to apple and orange to orange because all the programs have changed. But basically, we have about 25% of the federally funded beds we had 30 years ago. And that's a root cause issue. And so you have that combined with housing costs just skyrocketing. And I don't see it getting any better. And until people start worrying about the macro trends, every community is going to be dealing with this in a very, you know, significant way.
Now, you're talking about people who obviously clearly need services. I noticed in some of the work you had done in Northern California, I think it was in Mendocino County, you were concerned about people using services for the homeless who you didn't feel needed them. What did you perceive there?
Well, what we found when we went out and did our surveys is there are individuals that are moving up and down the 101 corridor, and we also saw this in Siskiyou on the 5 corridor, who would not be HUD-defined homeless. They would not be, by the definition, yet are using the very limited resources of the local nonprofits, and they simply are not HUD-defined homelessness. And so the concern is, when you have very limited resources, you add another 10 or 15% of the population that is using, whether it's food bank or a soup kitchen or overnight housing, when you're pushing out residents who are HUD-defined homeless, and that's what really concerns me.
I want to ask, before we go, I've got about a minute left here, Constance Wilkerson and Dan Bryant, the same question about whether people are looking for magic bullets, and when they don't get them, if they get a little discouraged. I mean, does the public expect something on homelessness that is just impossible to deliver, Constance Wilkerson?
When I'm talking with people in the Rogue Valley, they really want the homeless problem, as they call it, solved. And I think really they need to look at how we can create a housing first model and provide housing and then help people stabilize their lives. And, you know, that's how we deal with the situation.
Housing first. Okay, Dan Bryant, same approach for you.
Yeah, I tell people constantly, I'm a pastor of a downtown church as well as directing this nonprofit. We pay probably $1,000 a year just dealing with the garbage we pick up from what the homeless leave behind. And I say the problem is not the homeless. The problem is lack of housing and services and programs. That's what we have to focus on. When we make the homeless the problem, we totally miss what the crux of the problem is. We have to address the housing and the services and the shelter issue.
You and Constance both come from pastoral backgrounds. Constance Wilkerson, the Continuum of Care Homeless Prevention Coordinator in Jackson County. Dan Bryant, Executive Director at Square One Villages in Eugene. Mohammed Hassan Awad is a doctoral student at the University of Oregon Lundquist School of Business. And Dr. Robert Marbot Jr. from Marbot Consulting. Thank you all for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.